You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. On the podcast today, Michelle Lamont, the Harvard sociologist, discusses her new book, Seeing Others, which looks at how we assign value and recognition to our fellow citizens. The book analyzes how this process is constantly influenced today by an era largely dominated by increasing inequality. Joining Michelle in conversation is Sophie McBain. Sophie is associate editor of The New Statesman and often writes on issues such as psychology, the outlook of wider society, and the places where those two fields meet. Now let's join Sophie McBain and Michelle Lamont in conversation.
Michelle Lamont is a professor of sociology and African and African American studies at Harvard University, and she is a pioneer of cultural and comparative sociology. Her new book, Seeing Others, How to Redefine Worth in a Divided World, argues that we have lived for too long with a neoliberal idea that our worth is defined by our wealth and our achievements, and calls for a new way of thinking about how we value ourselves and others. She believes we need to realise that social recognition, the experience of feeling seen and respected, is a crucial component to our well-being, and that we need to collectively write new stories, new cultural narratives that afford equal respect and dignity to everyone, regardless of their race or gender or age or sexuality. In this book, she speaks to the change agents, among them activists, artists, writers, comedians, and young people, who are laying the foundations for a more inclusive society. Welcome to Intelligence Squared, Michelle.
Thank you, Sophie.
The central argument of your book is that social recognition, feeling seen and respected, is as central to well-being as things like money and power, and that culture can be as important for determining the shape of a person's life as economics. And I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that and about why social recognition has traditionally been slightly overlooked.
Sure. There are a great many reasons why it has been overlooked. Some of it has to do with this moment, which is often called a neoliberal moment in our history, with a strong focus on individualism and self-reliance and our ability as individual to pursue success and material accumulation. The social sciences as a whole are really based on a materialist assumption. It goes back to Marx, and we are often teaching students to think about self-interest, which is often defined in material term. However, we know that the literature on subjective well-being today very much emphasizes the importance of being valued by others. And conversely, there's a huge body of literature showing how the microaggression that comes with everyday experiences of racism translates into what epidemiologists call allostatic load, the wear and tear of everyday life that gets under the skin, which has all kinds of implication for subjective and physical well-being. So I think also when you interview workers about what they get from their work, often they put, the relationships that they build with their coworkers. They view this as important as the material resources that they obtain from working. So I think that really these are only a few facts that can encourage us to try to rethink some of the basic assumptions. There's a new book by Stephen Hetlin and his co-author Anderson titled The Science of Dignity that also provide really ample evidence of the, whether we call it recognition, respect of dignity, that these are really essential to human well-being.
Yeah, and how did your interest in this subject develop?
Well, I got the idea of writing this book. I've been working on questions of dignity for a long time. In 2000, I published a book titled The Dignity of Working Man, which was a comparison of French and American workers in Paris and New York. In 2016, I published another book titled Getting Respect, Responding to Stigma and Discrimination in the U.S., Brazil, and Israel. And with the Trump presidency, like many other people, I was a little shocked to see the ways in which, for instance, he was stigmatizing a Muslim with a travel ban to a number of Muslim countries early on in his presidency in February, I believe, of 2017. So I felt it was really, really important to try to give the general public the tools to think about recognition, because those tools are not so readily available in the public sphere. I mean, many people talk about wokeness, but that is very different than shedding light on some of the centrality of recognition to creating a society that empowers us to be more and to be happier, basically. And I should say, I was, like many people, depressed during the Trump presidency. So I was thinking about where do we find hope? And I read the social science literature on this topic. And the answer is that hope comes to human beings from being exposed to narratives that allow us to imagine an alternative reality. So that's why the book that we're discussing today is very much focused on interviewing and learning from people whose job it is to produce new narratives, and also interviews with young people, Gen Zs, people born after 2017, who themselves were very much struggling with mental health problems during the pandemic. And when we interview them, a lot of them are very much focused on trying to find alternatives to the American dream and new ways of finding hope at the time when they experience really a future that they view as a dead end for various reasons.
And I wondered about this idea of recognition and how social scientists think about it and measure it, because it seems like such a complex, slippery subject. Uh-huh. Because you might, for instance, to some people seem like an elite, and yet you're not accepted by who you'd imagine would be your peers. Like if someone is labeled nouveau riche, or being, say, a woman in academia and feeling like an outsider. Or there could be this disconnect between how people say they value you and then the microaggressions you experience that make you realize that you're also victim of unconscious or subconscious bias. So I wondered how sociologists try and get a grip on this kind of slippery concept and how you can measure it over time.
Yeah, well, at most basic level, recognition is understood in the mostly philosophical literature. The people who start writing on this early on is Hegel, the philosopher, and then more recently, philosophers such as Axel Hannette and Nancy Fraser. And they simply define it as defining a group positively. The counterpart is this notion of stigma, which was elaborated in sociology by Irving Goffman, which is defining groups negatively. So there are many ways of measuring this empirically. It has to do with self-image. The literature on identity is full of information on this. There's also one handy way of thinking about it is a disconnect between self-identification, what is my identity to myself, and how it is perceived by others negatively, which is often described in social identity theory as group categorization, and there's often a disconnect between those two things. So as a woman, I might think of myself as autonomous, smart, dynamic, but other people perceive me, let's say, as an older woman. I'm in my 60s, so dowdy, losing it, not entrepreneurial, like, you know, sleepy, whatever. So there's a lot of identity work that is done by everyone. That's basically what our book on responses to racism is about. You know, how do people do a lot of work to try to create more, you know, connection between these two definitions of who I am. And it's difficult to measure because much of this is happened in the context of a social process. Enter subjective definition of reality. You define me and I react by saying, no, you're wrong. It's not who I am. So what we found in the comparative book on getting respect in where we have Black people in the U.S., Brazil, and Israel, is that African-Americans in the U.S. confront, that's their response to stigmatization, whereas we found that Black Brazilians often were very uncertain whether they were victim of racism or they were discriminated against as poor people. So they were far less likely to want to confront because they simply had a lot of uncertainty. And a lot of what this book does is emphasize how the environment in which we are empowered African Americans. You know, you had the civil rights movement, you had all kinds of legal changes that recognized the, you know, how pervasive racism is for African Americans in everyday life. And there's also a lot of work done amongst themselves to check whether what's happening, you know, and to confirm, yes, this guy's a racist and therefore I'm entitled or I should confront him in this bigotry. So, you know, my contribution is not at all to talk about a measurement. That's really more the focus of people who study perceived racism. My colleague David Williams, for instance, it's really more to try to understand how alternative interpretation of what's happening are possible and how this is enabled by the narratives that surround us. If we are in an environment where there's never any, yes, let's say, you know, U.S. American society, 1920. I mean, it was much harder for African Americans to receive messages that racism was a deep attack on their dignity. Whereas in 2023 in American society, it's omnipresent. It would be extremely difficult for them to miss this. So really, the narratives that surround us are key to understanding how this works. So I would say, more generally, the book is far more oriented toward getting people to get an understanding of how this works. That's really my primary objective, much more than measuring. You know, I'm not an economist. That's not what I do. I try to make people understand how relationships unfold.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And when it comes to narrative, I wondered if you could say a little bit about the kind of impact of this kind of grand narrative of the American dream. And I thought one of the things that was really interesting and kind of sad is you describe it as more an American delusion, and that people might realize that the system is rigged and that not everyone who works hard can make it. But they tend to think that they might be the exception, that maybe if they worked harder, they would make it. And how does that shape a person's sense of self-worth and sense of social value?
Yeah. Well, it's been a very powerful myth for much of the 20th century. After all, there are waves upon waves of immigrants who came here believing that this is a place where it's possible to improve your situation and the fate of your family. But now we have several decades of growing inequality, not only in the U.S., but other advanced industrial societies. That's not only an American story, but we also have had, this neoliberal turn that I mentioned earlier, you know, symbolized by the election of Thatcher in the UK and Reagan in the US, which really a great emphasis put on market fundamentalism. You know, the state becomes a tool for accelerating all forms of market exchanges, and the individual who is not able to exercise self-reliance becomes deeply stigmatized, as, you know, welfare dependency is also greatly diminished. So our young people come to adulthood in a context where they have before them the millennials who entered the job market in 2008 after the Great Recession. And that generation is not able to buy houses. Very few of them make babies. And also, both generation, the millennials and the Gen Zs, are very critical of consumerism, in part because of their concern with climate change. So the idea that we should, you know, live to acquire the big house with a green lawn and the big car, and that we should constantly buy clothes, you know, they call this hedonistic treadmill, and it's viewed as illusionary. So if you don't believe that this dream is likely to become reality, where do you turn? So what we find in the 80 interviews we conducted with the young college students, middle class and working class students in the Midwest and the East Coast, is that often, instead of this, are embracing the idea of living their best life now, which for them means trying to live authentically. If they are gay, they don't want to be in the closet. If they are experiencing racism, they will express their strong feelings about it. And at the same time as they embrace authenticity, they also embrace trying to create the better society today, which is a society that they define as inclusive. So one could say that this is just wokeness, but for them, it's really a reality that they feel they have no choice but to push for, given the alternatives that have really vanished. You know, they are very critical of any universalistic perspective. And they strongly believe that we should be able to lead our best lives now. I remember I was teaching an undergrad course at Harvard 2 years ago during the pandemic, and one of them said, I want to be able to bring my best self to the classroom. And I asked, what does that mean? And the students said, well, I want to be able to be entirely here. I want to be able to express fully my views here. This is not a space where I should be hiding or I should be censoring myself. That's part of the learning experience. So I think it's important to understand where they come from, so that when they promote, for instance, non-binary pronoun, and they are strongly committed to this or to unisex restrooms, while this may seem extremely self-indulgent and not necessary from the perspective of many boomers, I think we have to understand where they come from and why for them accepting or promoting this, it becomes the symbol of what kind of society they want. And I'll conclude this little observation by an anecdote. Last summer, the American Sociological Association was holding its annual meeting, and the council had decided that, you know, our little labels that we have with our name on it, in the past, it was always you know, under the name, you had the institution where we teach. So in my case, Michelle Lamont, Harvard University, I walk in the hallway, people see this, people want to talk to me because I'm at Harvard. But many people felt that this use of our institution was deeply stigmatizing for people who are not in elite institutions. So they pushed so that instead of having name of our institution, we would have our pronoun. So you can imagine that many boomers were absolutely incensed by this change because they felt like first they don't want to be called they, them. They don't want to know what pronoun. So there was a huge divide at the meetings. The reaction around this change was really quite powerful, which is, I think, in itself very telling. I mean, instead of not of simply describing the young people's reaction as wokeness and indulgence, I think it's really important to try to understand why, where they come from and why it is important to them. Because the reality they've experienced is very different from the reality I've experienced as I was a 20-year-old in the early 80s when the job market was not perfect, but we all had a certain sense that there was openness for us ahead.
So you were happy to remove the Harvard from your...
Yes, from absolutely. Your label. It's become more complicated in the U.S. to be associated with these elite institutions, in part because even if, in my case, for instance, my approach to sociology, I mean, I'm an expert in the reproduction of inequality, so I've always studied how it is that inequality works, and I'm focusing on the cultural dynamics that are behind this. And people some often presume that because I'm at Harvard, I'm more of an elite and a guardian of the statu quo, while in fact, I'm really interested in how cultural change occurs. So personally, also by now, I think, you know, I don't necessarily need to proclaim my status as I operate in professional circles. You know, I'm much more interested in having interesting, innovative, original exchanges than anything else.
But that's interesting because it's a sort of example of being willing to give up some of your status or privilege for the greater good. Is that often a sticking point in when it comes to cultural change that people don't want to give up their privilege? That I know you write about things like affirmative action and middle class parents not wanting to send their child to the local school, which would improve the school in their district, but instead segregating themselves. And how do you get people to act against their personal interests in those contexts?
Yeah, well, I talk about this phenomenon that sociologists write about called opportunity hoarding, which is the idea that we should privileged people should be free to pass on all the privilege they have and all the resources they have to their children so that their children do as well as possible. And over the last few years, there's been a lot of criticism of this. You know, people have written about helicopter parenting and excellent sheeps. And they have certainly, which is, you know, those kids are so much encouraged to be overachievers. But what we know also is that these pressures have created enormous mental health problems for young people. There's a real epidemic of mental illness in that generation in the U.S., in part because I think while doing this, the parents send to their kids the message that you will be unconditionally loved if you succeed extremely well. And the kids end up feeling like they don't matter, which is why, you know, there are a lot of people now talking about mattering and addressing the mental health crisis by making their kids understand that they matter no matter how well they do. So that's one dimension. And so the book has all kinds of, you know, statements about what to do about opportunity hoarding and closure. And the idea also that it really benefits children to be exposed to a wide range of people. So in this neoliberal context in which we live, if we have a single hierarchy or matrix by which we measure people's worth, which is socioeconomic success, tons of people who feel unworthy. So one of the idea that I promote in one of the penultimate chapter is really to try to define a more pluralistic view approach to understanding worth. An example would be, you know, employers who are recognizing that their workers are not only producers, but they're also caregivers. So they can adjust working hours so that the employees can bring their elderly mother to the doctor or take care of their kids when the school is off. And doing this translates into far more loyalty for the employees toward their employers, and is much better in terms of mental health for everyone as well. So I think in this context of growing inequality, a lot of people who are privileged come to understand the downside of putting so much emphasis on materialism when it comes to children, that it's their well-being may be much better served if they join forces with their neighbors to create a more healthy society. So where I live, for instance, in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is part of Boston, basically, we have a Republican governor who recently passed a law to really encourage all communities that are served by public transportation to have more affordable housing. And of course, with the NIMBY movement, you would think that there would be a lot of objection. But in fact, there's a lot of support, in part because a lot of the younger couples or even middle-aged couples are extremely concerned by the environment. So here you have a case where climate change comes to the rescue, if you will, to really bring a lot of support to build multi-family housing and also affordable housing, so that the population density is increased, and instead of people having large lawns and more cars, etc. So I think there's really a shift in some of the younger people, you know, in how they think about these issues of opportunity hoarding, and also what is gained by having their kids attend schools that have more diversity. Raising your kids with, I've seen it certainly around me, with other extremely privileged kids is not necessarily very beneficial to them, because they end up living in a very rarefied environment. And with, you know, they certainly are impoverished by the lack of exposure to differences.
In terms of shifting narrative as well, it was very interesting to read your observation that narratives around attitudes towards homosexuality in America have shifted so dramatically since the 70s, but also in the last two decades. And I wondered if you could say a bit more about how that was achieved and what lessons we can learn from that to apply to other forms of discrimination and stigma.
The book discusses groups that used to be deeply stigmatized and have become less stigmatized, to say that social change is happening and that more can happen. And by pointing to who was involved in the creation of change, to demonstrate the kind of collaborations that have been productive. And that's a little bit of an argument against, you know, the psychologists who argue that we're all tribal, and that this idea that we're by definition, naturally, we are wired to like people like us and dislike people who are not like us. The book is very much an argument against this perspective. And I talk briefly about the case of the, you know, spread of same-sex marriage, which as soon as it was passed in 32 states, there was a rapid decline in the number of LGBTQ youth who attempted suicide, because the existence of these laws were interpreted by many people as a message that they belong, that they are full citizens, and that who they are gives them access to the most sacred institution of our society. I go in much greater detail in a comparison about people with HIV/AIDS and people who are obese. The first group was extremely successful at becoming destigmatized between 1880. When I came to the U.S., I was in Palo Alto at Stanford at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And today, where people with HIV/AIDS are not stigmatized anymore, people are not scared of them. At the beginning, it was very much viewed as moral failings. Gay men being promiscuous in public backrooms get punished by becoming, you know, sick with AIDS. And the book shows how there was a collaboration between social movement leaders and participants, together with social knowledge producers. So that includes legal expert, medical expert, social scientist, journalist, who all work together to really broaden our understanding of what causes AIDS and to remove the stigma, the moral blaming. And that was extremely successful. But you also had important people like Lady Di, who came to the U.S. and removed her gloves and was, you know, there were pictures showing her shaking the hands of people with HIV/AIDS, and Magic Johnson, this tall athlete, coming out very masculine saying, I have AIDS. Everyone can have AIDS. I can have AIDS. And then this collaboration between knowledge workers and social movements participants did not happen for people with obesity. It was very stigmatized 40 years ago, and it remains very much so. Although there are now popular artists such as Lizzo who are really militant about body acceptance, but the change is much slower because people who are obese are often blamed for their lack of self-care, laziness, lack of education. They're defined by lacks as opposed to, and you know, the militants were pushing this notion of healthy at any weight, but the medical profession was just extremely reluctant, although many people became much more critical of the BMI, so body mass index as a measurement. So things are moving, but so much slowly. But these two cases are presented to tell the reader, you see, things are changing and much more is possible. So at the same time, I acknowledge that there's a lot of backlash. Like, of course, right now in the US, it's a moment of great backlash against trans rights. So whatever is acquired is, you know, the process of institutionalization is you need to reach a point where those changes cannot be undone. And with the Supreme Court that you we have now in the US, a lot of very important things are getting undone. But, you know, the idea that you have a great arc of moral progress that Martin Luther King and Obama both often referred to has come under question seriously. But at the same time, if we look at social change in advanced industrial societies since 1945, there's no doubt that many minoritized groups and women have gained a lot of rights that they didn't have then. So it can be slow progress, but it's happening.
Yeah. What did the change agents you spoke to, the writers and artists, what were their methods that they used to try and shift narratives? Were they sort of very conscious about the methods that they were using, or was it through speaking to you that you I know you talk about things like sort of Trojan horse methods and things like that, that terminology came out?
Sure. So we did 185 interviews with people whose profession involves transforming narratives. So this involves policymakers such as Heather Boucher, who's on the council, you know, the current Council of Economic Advisors of Biden, Agent Poole, who is a labor leader for the National Alliance of Domestic Workers, all kinds of people. But this group also involves 75 Hollywood creatives, as well as stand-up comics. And together with some of my research assistants, we did interviews with all these people to understand, you know, many of them were saying, when we asked them, what motivates you? What do you try to do as you're telling your jokes? They came up with this idea that they're not forcing people to eat their vegetables, you know. They're not going to just come out and be lecturing people on diversity. But a lot of their messages has to do with, you know, maybe making fun of people who are racist, or maybe talking about their own reality as South Asian individuals, or as, you know, queer. So we developed a kind of typology that includes, you know, the idea one. So the Trojan horse is this idea of, you know, you plant messages in your jokes, or we talk about see it to be it, which is about the power of representation. So especially among stand-up comics, and I know very well that it is the case in the UK, as well, that they play a very important role in offering alternative. Another group that is connected to this is people who are creating shows that are being streamed. So one of them, the show Transparent, I interviewed Joy Soloway, who is the creator of this show. And when I talked to them, they said, I created this to help people make the reality of trans people, help people view the reality of trans people as less aberrant, you know, or abhorrent to the idea that, oh, this is a middle-aged woman who is now trans and she's trying to get her kids to understand her life as a trans woman. So, and everyone negotiates their relationship with their kids, not only trans people. So the language they use to talk about what they aim to accomplish with their work is very much to make people more human, to make them less stereotypical, to provide three-dimensional portraits of people, who people are, to represent them in the way that they would like to be represented, but also to represent them in a way that is dignified and not ridiculed. So these words are constantly used by the people we interviewed across various fields to talk about what they're trying to accomplish in their work.
I was so struck. I know you said at the beginning that hope is something so important. And I was struck by your finding that young people are becoming more optimistic. And I thought that was fascinating, given that this is a generation living with kind of the very, very real present threat of climate change, the pandemic, and stark inequalities, and the various backlashes against trans rights, against women's reproductive rights. And I wondered where this optimism is coming from.
Well, I wouldn't say that they're all optimistic. We interviewed them in the fall of 2019, and we interviewed them again during the summer of 2020. So that's really, you know, in the heat of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I would say their position was much more something like, the world is really going terribly. We have good reasons to be doomers. We don't want children, but we have to, if we want to continue to move forward, we have to find hope somewhere. And where you find hope is in the capacity to transform societies. So I use the term Gen Zs, although many demographers and sociologists are critical of the term because it's offered to us by marketing experts. And it's very hard to disentangle what is due to age, period effect, etc. But they very much define themselves as Gen Zs, by which they mean people who are deeply politically motivated. You know, they say, we're now in the cockpit, move over, boomers, you know, you screwed up with the environment. Now we're the ones who are going to create tomorrow's society. And that is very apparent in the current moment of strong unionization in the US, where there's a lot of victories that unions are experiencing, but they're often in sectors where you have a lot of young workers, Gen Zs and millennials, who participated in the Black Lives Matter movement, and they are very upset about social injustice. So just last week, there was a major victory from the automobile workers union. And since their corporations had been saved by the federal subsidies a few years ago, they felt very strongly that they deserved a very important salary increase. But it was not only about salary, it was also about dignity and about their work conditions. And I think what we see is a major focus on recognition claims among workers across the board, whether the Amazon workers who were asking for a time to go to the restroom, or the UPS workers who wanted to have air conditioning in their truck, in their cabins. So this is not only crumbs that are given to them. These are also demands that have to do with them wanting to be viewed and wanting to be workers whose dignity and human needs are recognized. And a lot of the recent writings on this renewal of the labor movement in the United States is very much tied to what young workers want. It's not the old, you know, 50-year-old, father figure who is just fighting for having more money. It's much more complicated than that. What they want a society that is more fair. So that, I think, this commitment gives them hope. And that's why they are so adamant, and some people would say so woke, but this for them, I think, is largely a question of survival, because if they go with the traditional order, you know, they may think that a lot of the job that will give them access to the big house are alienating jobs. They want to have a life that is, you know, that allows them to be who they are. So, and also, they don't necessarily know how long they're going to be alive, given what's happening with the planet. So I think that really gives them a very different timeline in how they think about what they want to accomplish with their lives.
Is this generation very unusual because of this historical moment? Or, I mean, what would you say to someone who's like, well, you know, actually, young people always want to change the status quo. They always want to do work differently, love differently, family differently. And then they end up living a lot like their parents in the end.
Yes, well, that is...
I mean, is that...
Yeah, that is certainly something that has been said about the boomers. And the boomers certainly, and I'm one of them, you know, there was the sexual revolution, there's the gender... You know, second wave feminism, there's a lot of things that my generation did. But recent studies of what happened to the boomers 40 years later, is many of them have continued to be innovative in ways. But what it means to be promoting social change 40 years later, we never talked about pronouns 40 years ago. And yet there are things that were truly significant in terms of social change that are now entirely taken for granted. So, you know, the definition of what progressive means certainly changes with times. And yes, the young people are more open to change. But at the same time, it varies a lot with social class. You know, half of the college students we interviewed have parents who are middle class. The other half have less privileged parents. And the less privileged students were much less likely to view themselves as revolutionaries, not because they don't want to be, but because they said, especially during the pandemic, we can't because we have to help our parents pay their bills. So, and one of the next step for my studies will be to focus more on the non-college students in this age group because their orientation is very different.
Yeah, and I suppose to pick up on this word woke, that there are also people on the left who are very critical of identity politics and who say, you know, it's a diversion from what really matters in terms of thinking about big economic structural reforms, and it's very alienating. People get scared about using the wrong language. It's language that doesn't translate well beyond campus. What's your response to that kind of line of attack from potential allies, I suppose, people who would themselves also call themselves progressives?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like sometimes these thinkers are kind of glorifying universalism and are not fully attuned to how much all forms of universalism have come under really strong attack, including the notion of human rights, for instance, which is perceived by at least half of the planet as a form of Western ideology. So I think it requires a little bit of humility to presume that what you believe are universal values should be embraced by everyone. They may not want these thinkers might not want to acknowledge the importance of recognition, but I think recognition is something that we can all have. It's not like a pie where if you get a piece, I don't get any. We can all gain recognition at the same time. It's true that it is associated with resources, but the book very much argues that if we are to focus more on the objective of broadening who belongs and who doesn't belong, it will be a major contribution to our collective quality of life. And I don't think that the arguments I've seen about wokeness contradict this perspective at all. So it's no question there's been a lot of abuse in the name of wokeness and cancel culture, and but there's a lot of abuse in the name of human rights as well, or in the name of universalism. So I think also that the focus on materialism is very much a focus of a certain era. I think, you know, in academia, the Marxists who were materialists were equally into cancel culture as the woke people. So I think this is more about openness to pluralism and ability to converse with others who don't share our opinion than it is about anything else. I mean, the term wokeness has come to be assimilated with all all vices, you know, while in fact, I think a lot of it has to do with the deterioration of a culture of deliberation that needs to be really strengthened and, you know, re-dynamized in not only on campuses, but everywhere.
Yeah. And as a final question for people who are listening to this and thinking, well, what can I do as an individual to contribute to building a world that is inclusive, that affords people the dignity they deserve and they want? What can any individual do?
Well, I would say in general, my answers are more at the level of what kind of society, how can we structure our environment differently so that we're more readily exposed to, you know, ideas that will encourage us to use a plurality of criteria for it, instead of simply focusing on socioeconomic status. I also talk a lot about ordinary cosmopolitanism, which has to do with emphasizing what we all share as human beings. There's, you know, I refer to interviews I conducted in the early 1990s for the book, The Technif Working Man, for which I interviewed a lot of North African immigrants working in France. And I asked them, what makes you similar and different to French people who, you know, these men were victim of racism every day. Many of them were illiterate. And they would really draw on their everyday experience, saying things like, well, we all have to get up in the morning and buy our bread at the baker. Or we all have 9 months in our mother's womb. Or we all have 10 fingers. Or they're good and bad people in all races. And these are themes that are also very central in the working class. And for this same book, I kept hearing comments such as, you know, you have to treat people as people. And that's one of the points of tension, because a lot of the working class men that Trump aims to speak to and to defend will easily draw moral boundaries toward minority groups, minoritized groups, and also, you know, blame these groups for lacking self-reliance. Yet at the same time, they embrace the notion that you have to treat everyone, people as people. So they are supporting populism in part because they object to elitism. And as we're thinking about the 2024 election, I think one of the big challenges is to figure out how to create a bridge between young people who are really embracing these values of authenticity and inclusion, at the same time as the Democratic Party aims to not entirely lose the workers who are really pulled, I think, between their desire to treat people as people and at the same time feeling, you know, very upset at the groups that they perceive as not pulling their weight. So these are among the big dilemmas ahead. I wish I had clear recipes on how to address them. But I think, you know, often when you publish a book, you're asked to write things for business journals where they ask you, what are the 5 concrete things people can do tomorrow? And I say, no, what we need to try to do is, you know, understand where people come from. We have to understand what is their lived reality and what leads them to understand the world the way they do. So understanding is probably one of the main things that we can ask both groups, frankly, young and patient people and the white collar, the working class that feels downwardly mobile, to try to demonstrate a greater understanding of other groups.
Yeah, well, it's been such an interesting discussion. So thank you so much, Michelle. That was Michelle Lamont, author of Seeing Others, How to Redefine Worth in a Divided World, available now from Allen Lane and Penguin Books and at a bookstore near you. I've been Sophie McBain. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening. This episode was produced and edited by Tom Hall. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.